Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now is Columbia University law professor Carol Sanger. Her new book is called About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
And a lot of this book, I see, is about how abortion might be protected as a constitutional right under Roe versus Wade, but governments at the state and local level and the federal level still pass laws designed to make a woman considering an abortion feel it's disreputable or immoral. How much is that the main point of your book?
That's a pretty good main point. And part of what I'm trying to do is show women, I think women might be heartened to know that if they feel rotten after having had an abortion, or they feel guilty even thinking about it, or they feel shamed, that it's useful for everyone to know that there, that for women to know that there's an entire apparatus of law and social practices meant to bring about exactly that result. So there's nothing inevitable about abortion and wickedness or abortion and shame.
So let's look at some of these laws. A big category is what you call women's right to know laws. What are they?
They are laws that have so it all depends what women want to know. The name is, of course, meant to seem women-friendly. And I did a little survey of what you'd want to know before you had an abortion. And none of the things in women's right to know laws were on the list that most women want to know about anything. And they're not called what women want to know about abortion. They're just what women want to know. In fact, one person said, I want to know why I earn less than my male counterpart. But that's a different program for you. One of the primary pieces of it are mandatory ultrasound statutes, which require women, before they can give legal consent to an abortion, to not only have an ultrasound, which many doctors do as a matter of course to locate the pregnancy and to date it, but be told by the physician, this is a requirement, would you like to look at the image of your unborn child, and in those languages, in those words. And some states even say the doctor must point out extremities, any identifiable body parts, the heart. And we also have heartbeat laws, which say you must listen to the sound of the heart.
They must.
The woman must. You must listen to the sound of the heart. You can close your eyes if you don't want to look at the ultrasound. But these laws, so that's one that you have before you consent. You also are told that in Texas and Indiana, a number of states, that you must bury the fetal or embryonic remains. And so those two things bracket it. First, we want to show you that what you're doing is killing your own child. And then at the end, we're going to make you go through a ritual that we reserve for born persons of mourning. And women may, in fact, feel bad about having had to make this decision, but they in no studies have I found have women wanted a do-over. You know, you feel terrible, would you change your mind? No, I would do the same thing.
Are there also some states – I think this was an issue in Pennsylvania some years ago, but I don't know if it got instituted where a woman has to see a film or read literature about the potential upsides and downsides, or maybe it's just the potential downsides of having an abortion?
It's done through disclosure requirements. So the downsides, according to some states, are suicidal ideation, a lifetime of guilt, regret, remorse. So it paints a very dark psychological picture. And while some women may take – I believe most women take this decision very seriously and may afterward think about it, reflect upon it, those are not – relief is also a major consequence of having an abortion.
And that's not in the literature.
That's not there. The other sorts of things are telling women, giving them ample information about adoption, and also telling them they have the right to compensation and child support from the father or the man they had intercourse with. Mm. And many women don't want anything to do with that person.
I always wondered if there's a mandatory information law, why it wouldn't include the risks and benefits of pregnancy and childbirth and unwanted child rearing, as well as the risks and benefits of abortion if a woman is at that precipice of deciding whether to keep a pregnancy. Does any law balance it like that?
No, they don't. They don't at all. And you would think that that would be something you'd want to know. What are what are the physical risks? Abortion in the early stages is way more safe, is much safer than childbirth. And this was something the Supreme Court addressed in this decision last summer called Whole Women's Health. It said states have to show now that the laws they are passing are good for women's health. They can't just say it. And so we might be seeing, depending what happens with the Supreme Court, we might be seeing more laws that are more states that are where the legislatures are required to give accurate information.
We have time for a few phone calls if anybody wants to call in for Columbia University Law Professor Carol Sanger, author now of About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. Anybody who's ever been through an abortion and been subject to the so-called women's right to know law in any particular state, or maybe, as we're about to get into, parental right to know laws if you were a minor, or even maybe partner right to know laws. So we'll get into all of this, and anybody who wants to call with your experience or a question, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Are there sex partner right to know laws?
No, there were. They actually weren't sex partner. They were husband right to know laws. So they figured they couldn't sort of delve into who brought about this pregnancy. They limited it, curiously, just to husbands and wives. And so it was one of the first laws out of the box after Roe v. Wade, laws saying husband had to give consent. And the court said
– consent, not just being informed.
Consent, right. This was one of the first – cases. Then and the court said, no, you didn't read Roe v. Wade carefully enough. It said this is a decision between a woman and her doctor. And even though we acknowledge the father, well, here it would be the husband, might have an interest in the pregnancy, the decision has to be made by the woman because it affects her life and body so much more. But then what you're thinking of is a case from Pennsylvania where they said, okay, we can outsmart the Supreme Court. Instead of requiring consent, we're just going to require notification. And there, this was a case in 1992 called Planned Parenthood versus Casey, an important case. And the court said, no, notification isn't good either because we think acknowledging that there are cases of domestic violence, they sort of acknowledged the social fact of domestic violence and decided that notification would give a husband enough to take away the keys, lock her up, bully her, threaten her. Of course, all those laws assume that husbands or fathers would not want the woman to have the abortion. And we have no evidence that that's true.
Or some might not, and that would be as much as they could get, the anti-abortion rights activists.
Yes, yes. But you also asked about parental rights. And parents in, I think, 37 states have laws called parental involvement laws, which say before a girl, a minor under 18, can consent to abortion, she has to either notify her parents or get consent. Different states treat it differently, and in some states she has to notify both, and in some only one. And these are really terrifying a proposition for a young girl who goes to a clinic. Most of them find out when they are able to find a clinic or provider who says, "And please bring the order from the court." They say, "What?" So, and this is not taught.
Court? What? Court?
Yeah, court. How do I get, where, what? And so they manage to find their way. Some of the states have good information online. Some don't. And they'd have to find it out online. Of course, you have to have a computer to do that. So it's a whole network of information they have to get. And then they have to go to court and have a hearing before a judge.
And there's a lot of political pressure to support these things in various states. The first time I interviewed Hillary Clinton was during the 1992 presidential campaign, New York primary season, and she came on the show when the show was just a baby, representing Bill. And one of the things I asked about was her support for parental notification laws in Arkansas yeah. at the time, which I think she then changed on.
Well, he didn't. He signed the bill. I mean, he signed it into law in Arkansas. And it's a good thing if she changed. There are many ways you could change it. You could say, let's take out 16 and 17-year-olds. You could say, let them go to someone else. Let them notify another trustworthy adult. There are many ways if you want to have an adult involved in this process and the decision-making to do it that are not so onerous. And most girls do tell their parents, or at least one parent.
We'll continue in a minute. We'll take some of your calls for Columbia University Law Professor Carol Sanger, author now of About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Columbia University Law Professor Carol Sanger. Her new book, About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. And Mary in Westport, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
You wanted to tell a story?
Yeah, so a couple years ago, I did help a friend of mine who had an unexpected pregnancy. She knew that was kind of the deal that her and her boyfriend, they had already made the decision to get an abortion, but she just needed help getting through the, like, obstacle course of actually having the procedure done. And what I learned was basically that all of these laws that basically stipulate a waiting period before the patient can consent are totally superfluous, because in most places you have to wait anyway for a doctor to become available.
How did this play out in your friend's case?
Basically, she had to take not one but 2 days off from work in order to go to the clinic first off to verify the pregnancy, and then the week after that we went to the clinic to actually have it done. At that point, we then had to wait all day because the doctor was only in for, like, one Saturday a month. Mm-hmm. And it was such a long patient roll that, you know, we may not have even gotten in. We were very lucky because Connecticut's a very small state. But for folks in, like, Texas, you know, you may have to drive for 5 hours right. to get to the nearest right. clinic and then pay for a room and board.
Right, because there are so few providers.
Well, two problems that the caller has raised. One is the effect of these waiting periods. It was 24 hours in some states, 48 in others, 72. I think one is up to 96. But in any case, what they're kind of infantilizing women, and they're assuming that women choose abortion on a whim. And you come in and you've gone through your own mental processes and checked with your own values and put this decision together for yourself. Then you go there and you find out, you schedule an abortion. When you go, you find out you have to go home. And as the caller said, not too bad in New York City. Well, we don't have that in New York City, but not too bad in places that have our where doctors do perform abortions. When you get to the plain states, there are no providers, and the distances to a clinic are much greater. This means women have to take time off work. They have to find people to take care of their children. They have to either invent a pretty creative lie, you know, visit to explain their absence.
And as Mary was saying, room and board.
And yeah, check into a motel. I mean, there are motels near clinics.
That far away from your home. Mary, thank you for sharing your story. And Jennifer, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I did endure an abortion many years ago, and I did have to power through picket lines and shouting people. But what it impressed upon me moving forward is the importance of having a discussion with my daughter, who's now 19, and my stepdaughter about birth control and how we all chose to have IUDs placed in them and how important it is, and honest talk. And what is not lost on me is that in this day and age, the 21st century, with personhood amendments, that access to birth control, so you don't have to be in the position I was in and make that decision, may also be at risk. And thank you. I'll take my here.
Thank you very much.
So personhood amendments are a tricky business right now. Interestingly, you might be heartened to know that the last four states that put personhood amendments on their ballots were defeated. So there's something going on, and there may be a disconnect between the population, the constituencies, and the state legislatures themselves. Personhood amendments are an end run around Roe v. Wade. Because they say, as a matter of constitutional law in this state, an embryo from the time of conception, when it's even less than an embryo, is a legally protected person.
You describe in the book how abortion needs to remain a private decision, but you say it doesn't need to be secret. Why do you distinguish between privacy and secrecy?
Well, that's a good question, because I thought about why do women not talk about abortion? Because many don't. I mean, I think Mary did. She said she spoke to her daughter about birth control and so on, and that's the way to go. But many women who suffer, she said she endured an abortion. I would say many women suffer their abortions, suffer the process. The process, if you have a 12-week surrender, takes about 10 minutes, not counting just recuperating for an hour. But the lack of conversation about abortion at the private level, many mothers don't talk to their children. Daughters rarely tell their – adult daughters don't always tell their parents. Husbands, wives don't always tell their husbands. And there are all these other – women go to doctors. They don't use their own OBGYN. They go to a doctor who doesn't know them. So there's all this – you might call that privacy. I would call it secrecy. And the distinction
–
yes, and that's the distinction. Privacy is sort of powerful. I get to decide who knows what about me. Secrecy is something different. It's non-disclosure because you're scared of what will happen if you disclose.
I think we have a story kind of to this point. Claire in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling, Claire.
Hi. Yeah, it's very similar to that point. My sister kept a secret of her abortion because of the shame around the entire procedure. She was in college at the time, really needed to have it. It was the best decision she could have made, but she went through the entire process alone, and at the time lived in Florida, so it was really difficult. She had to, there's not very many centers. It was an entire process. She had to pay for it out of pocket so it wouldn't show up on my parents' insurance. And I would have normally been the person she would have told, but I had to have a hysterectomy in my teenage years because of some medical issues, and the process of making her listen to the heartbeat and look at the image made her feel so much guilt and shame because of my medical issues that I can't have children. And she felt so much more trauma from being put through that entire process, which was just unnecessary. And it infuriated me so much that she felt she needed to keep that secret, that she needed to feel shame around it, the decision she needed to make. It's not my place to judge.
Because it wasn't your social pressure on her to feel shame. It was society's pressure on her to feel shame relative to you.
Right, which is just not fair.
Claire, and I have to leave it there because we're running out of time, but
thank you
so much. It was probably not an easy story to share.
Yes, thank you. And I just want to say it's not just society, but it's the law. And so that's worth keeping in mind, that this is all required not because doctors voluntarily do it. They object to a lot of this.
And so for you as a law professor, this is what your book is about, and you're looking at all these laws that even while abortion is a constitutionally protected right under Roe, try to push at the fringes of it through these various information laws and other kinds of things designed to impose shame, etc. So in our last 45 seconds, for you as a law professor, Neil Gorsuch, in his confirmation hearing, did refer to Roe versus Wade as the law of the land. Was that any kind of indication to you that he would not vote to overturn it if given the opportunity?
Well, because I want him not to vote to overturn it, I could put a lot of stock in that. It's possible, although his mentor, Anton Scalia, Antonin Scalia said he would overturn it. But I think it's an important point that the Casey case, what I talked about earlier, the judges in that case said, if I'd been on the court when Roe was decided, I don't think I would have voted that way. But I'm not. I'm on the court now, and it's the law of the land. And so I think we have to hope he meant that.
Carol Sanger, Columbia University law professor and now the author of About Abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.